everybody. Welcome to episode 751 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
I'm Manny.
And this is your New Comics Wednesday episode for March 6, 2019. Manny and I are going to be talking about a few of the books that we've got a chance to read already. Obviously, spoiler-free, we want you to be able to go and pick them up and check them out for yourself. But we'll go over a few of the titles that we read today. We'll pick out, I guess, our favorite book of the week for the titles we've read so far. And we'll also give a rundown on some other titles that you may want to be on the lookout for. And just a reminder, everybody, we know that we tend to go a little DC heavy here. And it's because Manny and I are really huge DC fans, honestly. But another reason for it is that a lot of publishers don't send us their preview stuff. And DC is one that always does. Like, we get it first thing on Friday, and it gives us an opportunity to check them out and let everybody know, you know, what they should be picking up. Aftershock is another company that does right by us and gets us the books, as well as Image and Valiant. Dark Horse, you know, they always say, yeah, we'll get you the books, and then they never show up. Same thing with Boom. IDW is another one that gives us access to their books, but they don't send them. We have to, like, log in and download them. So, and honestly, I'm not reading that many IDW titles these days. So anyways, I just wanted to kind of remind everybody, we really would love to bring you some previews and some opinions on a lot of Marvel titles, you know, before you hit the comic shop on Wednesday. But unfortunately, they just, unless you're a giant website, you know, or Entertainment Weekly or the New York Times or something, they're not interested in letting people read their stuff and talk about it. I honestly don't understand it. Maybe they just don't like giving stuff away for free, but you know, it's free advertising also. So again, I'm not really sure. I'm not going to rail against Marvel. You know, I have in the past. I think they are improving in terms of the quality of their stories and some of the decisions they're making, but they're still putting out just way too many comics and way too many variants. The War of the Realms series that's coming up from Jason Aaron, I know it has a lot of people excited, and that's great. You know, I haven't read any of Jason Aaron's Thor. I don't plan to. I don't plan on checking out War of the Realms. But regardless of that, when you have a book that's coming out, and in order for somebody to get all the variant, like if you're going to go all in on War of the Realms and you want to get all the variants for issue one, you're going to spend $150 on like one variant, one, you know, book basically with different covers. It's insane the amount of material, War of the Realms material that Marvel's putting out. Again, it's not good for the industry. You know, we recently had the Comics Pro meeting in over on the East Coast. I think it was in West Virginia, and you know, a lot of the retailers were getting up saying the same things. Like, Marvel, you gotta help us out. You know, you gotta stop with the variants. And I think Brian Hibbs, he from Comic Experience in San Francisco, he had a good idea of saying, hey, when you put out a variant, it can only be X amount, X percentage of the output that you put out, you know, because you have publishers like Zenoscope where every single comic they put out has like 20 variants, and the industry just it can't support that. And we're seeing comic shops close left and right recently, and honestly, it's starting to feel a little bit like the crash of the 90s, and that's not a good thing. So anyway, there's my little mini rant before we get into the books today. And a reminder for you all to get out there and support your local comic shops. Remember, nothing is better in terms of supporting your local shop than pre-ordering and telling them what you're in. You know, even if you're not paying for it ahead of time, even if you're not, you know, filling out a previews 2 months ahead of time, if you're just at least communicating to your shop that, hey, this book's coming up and I'm interested in it, at least that gives them some idea of what to order and what they should be paying attention to. If a shop is hearing everyone talking about, oh, I can't wait to hear War of the Realms, they're going to have an idea that, yeah, their people are interested in it. We can order a little bit heavier on it and not get stuck with a bunch of product, as opposed to they don't hear anything and then they order a little light and you show up and it's not there. Then they miss out on a sale and you miss out on getting the book you want. So again, it's it's always to your benefit, and it really helps out the shop a lot if you let them know what it is you're looking to pick up. And even if it's just a couple weeks in advance, you know, it doesn't have to be the full 2 months in advance when the previews catalog comes out, because they can always up their orders through the final order cutoff deadline and the Diamond portal, web portal on their computer. So just our normal PSA, and just to remind everybody how you can help out your comic shop. And before we get into the issues that we're going to talk about for this episode, just a reminder that this episode of The Comic Source is sponsored by Aftershock Comics, the independent comics and graphic novel publisher sending shockwaves throughout your local comic shop with groundbreaking series. Manny and I are both really big fans. I think a lot of their content is edgy and relevant, and they've got incredible creators right from the start, with creators like Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor, Paul Jenkins, Garth Ennis, that helped launch Aftershock. So currently, A Walk Through Hell number 8 is going to hit comic shops this Wednesday. Talked about it on the most recent Aftershock Monday episode. Also talked about Oberon. The second issue of that from Ryan Parrott and Miloš Slavkovic hits comic shops this Wednesday as well. They have other great groundbreaking series like Animosity by Marguerite Bennett and Rafael De La Torre, and Stronghold. First issue dropped recently from Phil Hester and Ryan Kelly, and I'm really looking forward to the Out of the Blue hardcover, which is coming soon. It reunites writer Garth Ennis and artist Keith Burns after the success of their series Johnny Red, and this is another World War II aerial combat tale, and it's presented in very high quality, great covers, great story, and again, the value and quality of Aftershock hardcovers can't be overstated. It's really a great series that I'm looking forward to. So be sure you go and check out All That's Shaking at AftershockComics.com. And remember to read dangerously this year in 2019. That's what Aftershock is challenging all of us to do. So let's go ahead and dive into the issues for this episode. You want to kick it off, Manny? What are you going to talk about first?
Well, I'm going to talk about a series that you had told me that you were just turned off by, just because you're not a Grant Morrison guy. So I kind of, after the first issue, just given where I was with reading, I kind of put it on the bottom of my pile. And you know what? It's better than I thought. I'm talking about The Green Lantern. In this case, it's issue number 5. It's written by Grant Morrison with the amazing artwork of Liam Sharp, colored by Steve Olive. So if you've been following the story so far, the first 4 issues, it's really weird, to say the least, in the sense that it's, you know, a really alien-oriented, I mean, just... For a while, I had a little bit of trouble figuring out what was going on. They're trafficking planets. They had stolen planet Earth. Somebody had stolen planet Earth, and they were selling it off. Now, the people who were auctioning the planet had hired these Black Stars to protect them. And through some events, which I cannot talk about because it's actually part of this issue. Last issue, issue 4, we find that there's a space cowboy who's trying to join the Black Stars. And by the end of it, Countess Belzebeth, who's the leader of the Black Stars, discovers that this cowboy is actually Hal Jordan disguised. So at the end of that issue, we find out that he's willing to even give up his ring in order to join the Black Stars. So this issue takes place on planet Vor, which is a planet of vampires. And this is where the Countess is going to test Hal Jordan and see if he's worthy of becoming a Black Star. He has to prove himself through I guess it's almost like an obstacle course, which is going to have 3 different stops. At every stop, he's going to learn a new lesson. He's going to have to make a sacrifice. But he's going to get a gift as well. And if he can get through the planet, in which she mentions that everyone and everything's trying to eat him. At the end, she will find out if he's worthy of becoming a Black Star. Through his trials, it's really entertaining. The outcome is kind of what I had expected, but with a cool little twist at the end. And so, actually, I think this is a really good book. And I think it had to do with the fact that you and I, Jace, are really big fans of Liam's art. So seeing Hal go through these trials in such detail, it was really, really entertaining. And I gotta say, the dialogue between the Countess and Hal Jordan throughout the trials, I thought was great. So put them both together, and it made for a really, really entertaining issue, and it flowed really, really well. And this is a really, really good issue. Some of the previous issues, more specifically 2 and 3, really just kind of had my head spinning, and I almost had to reread them to figure out what the heck was going on. But this one, it was just really, really enjoyable.
Yeah, I actually agree with you. So I'm not a big Grant Morrison fan. I've gone on record of saying that a bunch of times. Honestly, I feel like sometimes his writing, he makes these references and calls back to things that are so obscure that not even me, who I feel I'm a pretty big comic book fan, he calls back on things I've even never heard of. And I think a lot of today's casual readers can get lost as well. And so you kind of have to take all that with a grain of salt. And sometimes it seems like the story takes a backseat to Grant trying to be clever and call out all these kind of obscure references, or it takes a backseat to him just trying to be weird for the sake of being weird. It's not in service to the story, right? And I didn't feel like there was a whole lot of weirdness in this issue. It was more straightforward. And that happens. Like, I think it's happened on about 2 issues so far, maybe issue 3 and issue 5, where everything seemed really kind of straightforward. And it was like an easily understood issue, and I didn't feel like I was getting lost. And so, yeah, I think this has been probably the best issue to date. And I keep telling myself, yeah, I'm going to it's too weird. I'm going to stop reading Green Lantern. I think I said that after issue 2. And then I was like, let me give it one more. And then 3 was good. So then I read 4 and I was like, I'm probably done. And then issue 5 comes out. Great cover by Liam. And I'm like, well, you know what? Let me just read one more issue. And now it's great. Now I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely going to keep reading this. And honestly, it's like it's a Liam Sharp art. And I know I said before, just based on the art, I'm buying physical copies of this comic, even though we get the preview copy. But yeah, I want to support Liam. I want to look at his gorgeous art. Whether or not I read the story, you know, I go back and forth. But for now, I'm back in, and we'll see. It's an interesting story. And the other thing that I really liked about this issue, so right at the end, I think it's like the next to last page, we get like a full page splash of another character, not obscure at all, like another right. DC cosmic character. That's going to lead into something interesting happening in next issue. But I bring it up, I don't want to spoil by saying it, who it is, but I bring it up only to say that if we got a series starring that character, I really would want Liam to draw it. That character, the way Liam drew him, was awesome. There wasn't, you know, it wasn't like super extravagant or even as detailed as Liam can get sometimes. But I just really liked the look of that character as Liam illustrated him. I thought it was really, really great. So I guess we'll see. So far, the odd issues of Green Lantern have been good, and the even not so much. We'll see what happens with issue 6. All right. So the first comic I'm going to talk about, this one is similar, actually. It's had 2 good issues and 1 not so good. But it's Young Justice number 3. And it's from the creative team of writer Brian Michael Bendis. We have Patrick Gleason and Victor Bogdanovic on art, Jonathan Glapion and Alejandro Sanchez handling the inks, Chris Sotomayor and Hi-Fi are doing the colors, and Carlos S. Mangul and Josh Reed are handling the letters. It's interesting how many people are working on some of these Wonder Comics books. I don't know if they're just falling behind. They've already fallen behind. You have tons of people working on them to get them out on time. But I didn't think that... I thought the art here was pretty consistent, actually. I didn't even realize Patrick Gleason had drawn any of the pages, but now that I look at it, it's obvious to me. And it's obvious which ones are Gleason and which ones are Bogdanovic. Their art styles are kind of similar, but they certainly have their own distinct looks. So, as I said, issue one was great, just being reintroduced to all the Young Justice characters. I felt like issue two, I don't know, I felt like I missed a couple pages. I missed something between issue one and issue two because it felt a little disconnected. And now issue three has that really fun tone that issue one had, but it also kind of ties into issue two. So maybe issue three could almost be like the connective tissue. And when you read it all in one sitting, it's probably going to make a lot more sense. But, you know, Brian Michael Bendis is kind of known for his dialogue. And at times he has a tendency to make all his characters sound the same, like they all kind of speak in the same sort of witty banter, and that can be a problem. It didn't go too far down that path in this issue, but I can see where the danger lies. Like, not every character, not every superhero, especially the young ones, is going to make wisecracks and drop one-liners. But here, between Bart Allen, which that, you know, impulse, that makes sense that he would be doing that. Superboy, Connor Kent or Connell, less so. And so, again, I think that's the danger that Bendis has to watch out for. But I did enjoy this issue. As I said, it felt like we're starting to get a little bit of connectivity into the story. Brian Michael Bendis is acknowledging the fact that there's all this continuity stuff that some people are asking and they care about a lot. Like, you know, okay, so where has Superboy been? How does it all make sense? How is Tim Drake Robin again instead of Red Robin? And he makes some references in story to it, and whether or not it'll all get resolved or whatever. I'm not as much of a continuity nut as I used to be in the past. I think continuity's fine. And it helps you feel like you're part of something when you are in the know and you've followed along with the stories. But if you give me the choice between really good, tight continuity and everything making sense and fitting in and a good story, I think the good story is more important than the continuity at this point. So if it all ties in and makes sense, that's great. If there's a few things where you just kind of have to not think about it too hard, then I think that's okay too, as long as it's a good story. And this is starting to feel like it's going to be a good story. As I said, after the second issue, I wasn't sure. I felt like we had one good issue, one bad issue. I wasn't sure where we were going to end up. But this is Young Justice. It has a very youthful feel. I think it's great for younger readers. And I'm not sure how much they care about continuity. But at least Bendis is putting some nods to it in this comic, and it gives hope, I suppose, for older readers who really care about that they may get some resolution and answers to those questions that everybody's asking. As far as artwork, I already mentioned Gleason and Bogdanovic, their art styles are similar enough that it's not it doesn't feel inconsistent. And I actually like their art, especially Victor's art. I think it's got a little bit of a cartoony feel. So does Gleason's as well. As I said, similar styles. But also very dynamic, very action-oriented, which suits this book really well. The other thing is the color palette. I'm a little surprised at the choices that Chris Sotomayor and Hi-Fi are making here, just because they're, you would think a title with a very young team of superheroes, and the fact that it is very much a traditional superhero comic, that you would have really bright colors, you know, really primary colors, and it doesn't. It's a little bit of a muted palette, and I don't know if that's because of where the story is set or if they're making the choice for another reason. I'm not really sure. I almost think it would play better if the colors were a little bit brighter, but there's a huge reveal, a huge part of the story, something we learn about Superboy, about Kal-El, that's probably going to have a lot of people talking, and we'll probably even see maybe a few articles written about it tomorrow or today as this comes out. But obviously I'm not going to spoil it here, but I was pretty surprised when I saw it, so I'm curious what everyone's reaction is going to be. But yeah, I do recommend picking up Young Justice. It's been a lot of fun. I never watched the cartoon, so I can't say whether or not the tone is consistent with what the cartoon was. But I'm curious to know what some other Young Justice fans are thinking about this, and particularly my buddy Todd Nock, who used to draw Young Justice. I'm sure he's reading this. And I'm going to see him at the end of the month at WonderCon. I'm going to have to pick his brain and find out if he's been reading Wonder Comics and specifically Young Justice and see what he thinks about it.
Up next, I have Batman 66. This one continues the nightmare sequence that we had left off before the Flash Batman crossover four-part event. And creative team, obviously, still Tom King, writer. This one has a different artist, George Forns, with Dave Stewart on colors. And, it picks off right where we left off before with Professor Pig before the, like I said, the four-part event. And so the nightmares continue. We know that someone's forcing Batman to live through some of his fears, some of his anxieties, reliving some of his worst traumas. In this case, the trauma is Selina Kyle, Catwoman. And throughout this entire issue, it's a back and forth between Selina Kyle and The Question, who I haven't seen in a while, so that was pretty cool. But what I really enjoyed about this issue is that it kind of goes into the past and how they met in this case. And they really, really dig deep into kind of who Batman is to the core. I mean, explaining his vow and how important that is. And then also there's a really, one of my favorite parts of this book is one where they're fighting him, Batman and the Justice League are fighting a Kraken or something, and you can kind of you see the difference in heroes in Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman as they enter the fight. The difference between them, Batman, and I thought that was done really, really well. And then they go on to talk about his vow and things like that. And then also, of course, the relationship between them. And I just thought that it was done really, really well. But what's interesting about it is, the question is this a part of the nightmare that he's now controlling? Is he just going along for the ride? So many questions here to what's going on. And I really scratched my brain as to what the heck, Tom King is doing here. And you know, if I keep talking, probably gonna give too much away, but it's a really revealing issue as far as Batman, the character, and who that superhero is. And so I really, really enjoyed it. I think I've read it two or three times just because I thought it was written really well. The artwork, I didn't care for it too much. It's not really what the type of art that I like. It's really, really more simple that form does here. I know it's a dream sequence, or it's a nightmare sequence, so sometimes there aren't any too much around you. It's just because you're probably in a cloud or in a fuzz, but most of these pages have a lot of lack of depth, lack of backgrounds and things like that, that just really make it kind of, in a sense, feel empty. And I'm not sure if that's maybe what they were going for, but that's kind of the feeling I got. So it's still really, really good. And I just can't wait to see where the heck all of this is leading.
Yeah, so it's interesting to hear you didn't like the art that much. I've heard a lot of people talk about Jorge Fornes's art. You know, it's the same guy that did Hot Lunch Special, and there's tons of detail in the art he did there. And he's done Batman before as well. I think he teamed up with Mikel Yanin, where Yanin did the it's the issue where Commissioner Gordon gets the baseball bat and goes up and breaks the bat signal. And I think Mikel Yanin did all the Jim Gordon issues, or all Jim Gordon panels and pages, and Jorge Fornes did all the Batman pages, where that's the issue where Batman was going around literally like beating the crap out of people. And everybody's
was that 51 or 52, I think?
Yeah, I think so. And I keep hearing people say they keep likening his art to David Mazzucchelli, who did the art in Batman Year One with Frank Miller. And I guess I can kind of see it in terms of like the silhouettes and sort of the panel layouts. But I think the difference is the coloring. Mazzucchelli art was a lot, it was just colored differently. And I probably should know this, but I don't know if Mazzucchelli colored himself on it, or if there was another colorist that did a Year One. Again, it's probably something I should know, but obviously Fornes is not coloring himself here, and it's laid out differently. He doesn't make as much use of shadow as Mazzucchelli does, and so that's probably the biggest difference in my mind, and why to me Fornes's art doesn't for me personally invoke Mazzucchelli. Like, I get why people are saying that based on the style, but I didn't mind the art, but I do think that for whatever reason, I liked Jorge's art when he did the previous issue of Batman, maybe because he got to draw a lot more Batman. And here it's mostly Catwoman and the Question. But I did enjoy the story. I really love what Tom is doing with Batman. It's very cerebral. And I especially liked the other character besides Catwoman that's in the book, and how it gets a little bit meta when she's trying to figure it out. Exactly what's happening, and she's questioning this other person, and this other person is, you know, explaining to her why he's there. It just gets, as I said, really, really meta when you're trying to find answers to questions, and I just thought it was really cool and a neat trick, and no surprise that Tom would do something like that. So yeah, really enjoying Batman. I saw the other day on Twitter that he said that he had submitted his outline for like the last 35 issues or so, like issue 70 to 75. So it's hard to believe it's getting down to it, you know.
Wow.
It still comes out twice a month, so you know, it's only a little more than a year away, and we'll be done, like 17, like less than a year and a half. We should be done with Tom's run on Batman, which is crazy. Wonder what he'll do, if he'll do another big long run on something like that. I'd really love to see him do something like that on Superman. Get Bendis out of there. all right, let me talk about my next book. It's speaking of endings, it's Green Arrow number 50, which it's an extra-sized final issue. And what's interesting is when this latest creative team came onto the book to take over for the Benson sisters, they didn't know that the book was coming to an end. And so they were they had kind of long-term plans, and then it didn't work out that way. The powers that be at DC decided, no more Green Arrow. I'm not sure why. I'm not sure if it plays into what happened in this story, but I'm very, very curious. So this issue is written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing. We have art by Javier Fernandez. Colors are by John Kalis. Letters are by And World Design. First thing I'll say is the art. Javier Fernandez, when he first started on this title with the Benson sisters, I feel like his art was a lot cleaner. It got a little bit more sketchy toward the end, or at least for this particular issue. And that might have just been because, again, it was a double-sized issue. And so he had, or not double-sized, but extra-sized, like 36 or 38 pages as opposed to the normal 20. So almost double. And I just wonder if he rushed a little bit trying to make sure that he finished. I mean, the art is great in terms of layouts, and it's just a little light on backgrounds. And again, it's not as detailed as Javier's art has been in the past. But I still think that, you know, the art's good. There's a couple of montage pages, which are really cool. And as far as the story itself, so in a way, it kind of, like, the impetus of the story, this one particular issue story, doesn't necessarily make sense to me. It feels a little bit like the writers are stretching, especially as it pertains to the relationship between Black Canary and Green Arrow. It doesn't feel 100% like authentic, you know? Some of the decisions and choices they make, I'm like, I just don't see them going that way. But that being said, like, if you like forget about that and just look at this as a standalone issue, this is a hell of a ride. It is really, really fun, and I feel like if the pacing and action of Green Arrow had been like this for a long time, then I don't think this title gets canceled. But I think the Benson sisters were trying to do something different, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I love what they were doing. But then when they left, I think the book kind of floundered a little bit, and it was kind of searching for its identity. And I even saw that Colin King put it, it was either on Twitter or Facebook, somewhere on social media, that he put out, I think it was Colin. I'm pretty sure it was Colin Kelly. Anyway, one of the writers was saying how they didn't feel like they could ignore everything that came before them. So they were trying to sort of pay homage and be respectful to what came before and start setting things up so they could still use what came before, but then start telling the story that they wanted to tell. And then right as they were starting to get all the setting set up and everything lined up, then they heard it was canceled. So I feel like they didn't really get a chance to do what they might have done because they were so limited on time. Plus, they had the whole issue they had to dedicate to the memorial for Roy Harper, who died in Sanctuary in the pages of Heroes in Crisis. So again, I feel like they didn't necessarily get a fair shake. And it's too bad because, like I said, this one particular issue, this issue 50, is so good and shows what these guys may have had in mind in terms of how fast-paced and action-oriented it was. And I feel like if they'd gotten to do this right from the start when they took over for Julie and Shauna, then maybe the book wouldn't have gotten canceled. But again, I don't know that it got canceled because of sales. I don't know why. I don't know if they have other plans for Green Arrow. It's interesting, some of the things that we see in the story here. You know, speaking of continuity, there are some things that tie into what Scott Snyder's doing over in Justice League and some things that we saw in No Justice. So, again, it feels like a very strange issue to end on because it's so good. I really, really enjoyed it. And, I'm going to miss not having Green Arrow. Green Arrow, when Benjamin Percy took it over, ever since then, and even before, I mean, what Lemire did with it, Green Arrow's been a really quality title for a long, long time. So it's why it kind of surprises me that we're not going to have a Green Arrow title on the stands. I'm very grateful that we got that Benjamin Percy run on the character. That was absolutely spectacular. As I said, I loved what Julie and Shauna did in their brief time on the book. And this one particular issue, I think the writers, Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing, should be very proud of this issue because it's something special. So do yourself a favor and pick it up and check it out. Like, I don't even think you need to have a complete understanding of what's been going on previously in Green Arrow because it doesn't tie in that much to what's going on. You can totally get caught up based just on the context of the story. If you've been reading Justice League or you read No Justice, you'll get a little more out of it because there's a scene at the end that makes a little more sense. Or it will be more impactful if you know about this object that Oliver has possession of. But even if you don't, I think, again, it's a really, really great story. Did you get a chance to check out Green Arrow 50, Manny?
No, not yet. And actually, it's kind of just because of the fact that I know that it's going to be final issue. And I mean, there's so much more story to Green Lantern to tell. And kind of like you were saying, when Percy took it over, I mean, that for me, thinking about it, was probably one of the most consistent, maybe, okay, no, not okay. Well, yeah, one of the most consistent books with the really, really captivating story. And it was always pretty well grounded, and they had a really good vibe between Oliver and Black Canary. I mean, just it was just so good. And then even when the Bensises took it over and what they did with the Citizen and things like that, that was so good. And then just to see when the came out that it was going to be canceled, and you know, they were on Twitter kind of explaining what it was going to be and this and that, I felt really, really bad, because I just don't see how you I don't understand how you can cancel Green Arrow. And to me, it makes no sense. I'm gonna be reading it tonight, and just, you know, be a bitter, like, based on what you say, it's gonna be a bittersweet goodbye, and I just don't think it's justified to be getting rid of this book that's been so consistently good. I mean, artwork wise, story wise, just, I mean, it was one of the top selling books at the beginning of Rebirth too. So I think we just talk about it a lot.
Yeah, the other thing about this particular issue is that I've never gotten the impression more so than in this issue of just how skilled Oliver Queen is. Like, this really shows how he can hang with like Batman and Superman and the, you know, the real icons of the DC universe, because he is so formidable in this issue. It's really cool to see. And I really appreciated that from the writers. And again, I just felt like, man, I would have liked to have seen more of that. Because I think in recent years, we've gotten a lot of Green Arrow with self-doubt, and I don't know if I can stand with gods and blah, blah, blah. And it's nice to see him brimming with confidence and kind of holding his own. And the other thing I'll say about the Green Arrow title overall, since Rebirth started, it wasn't just a Benjamin Percy writing, but we had Otto Schmidt, Juan Ferreira, and Stephen Byrne doing art on you know, they were kind of, those three were kind of rotating, and when they do their arcs, they would handle pencils, inks, and colors, and it was incredible art, man. And I don't know what Otto Schmidt is doing now. I haven't seen his name on anything, but I will read anything that Stephen Byrne draws, and I'll read anything that Juan Ferreira draws. And I've followed Stephen since I discovered his work on Green Arrow, and same thing with Juan. You know, Juan's over doing Killmonger right now at Marvel, just about to finish up or just finished up. And now he's doing this incredible series in Moon Knight, incredible Moon Knight series in Marvel Comics Presents, actually. And Steven's doing Wonder Twins. So again, incredible artists who put their stamp on, at least for me, on the character of Green Arrow, and did an incredible job. So if Green Arrow comes back, man, I would love to see either Juan or Steven return to the character. That would be great. All right, what do you have up next, Manny?
Okay, so I don't want to end this on a negative note. So my next book is Female Furies number 2. And did you get a chance to read this one?
Yeah, I checked it out.
Okay, well, I absolutely hated it. Just, I mean, from... I thought that maybe it would maybe skew a little bit to less of a misogynistic story and focus more on the Furies. But I mean, from the entire time, it's really just about their leader Aurelie and what she's dealing with Protector Willix and the rest of her team putting pressure to just deal with it. And this is really not the book that I would have liked to see the Female Furies in. because I feel like it's really the opposite of what I've always envisioned the team of Furies. So, and I mean, and I can, and just based on the title is of this issue, Nasty Woman. I see what they're doing. I mean, it's a clear shot at Donald Trump and you know, that regime of sexism. And I just could not get on board. And then I cannot be more unsatisfied with the way that Darkseid has been portrayed. He's almost kind of like, I mean, just one of the guys, and that's not who or what Darkseid is. I can see, I can give you Steppenwolf being that way. I can give you Wilkes, but just as powerful and as amazing as I've always seen the female Furies to be. I mean, I'm talking about Barda and La Sheena, Stompa and Bernadette. It's just doing it a disservice of how great this team can be. And, especially a character like Barda, it rubbed me the wrong way the entire issue. And I was hoping that, just the path that they were going to take, that it was an issue one, and then we were going to maybe get the follow up. But instead of actually following more or less the actual crisis at hand, as you know, at the end of issue one, they murder the nephew of Steppenwolf, and that's really an afterthought in the issue. I don't want to give away too much in it, but just there's something that Granny Goodness does too, which I mean, yeah, I get it, it's at her level, but I don't see her doing that to one of her girls, one of her soldiers, and I just. They're so weak to me at this point, all of them. I have not enjoyed this issue at all. And the only thing I can say though is I love the artwork. It's really looks like a 90s book. It's kind of nostalgic. I love the way that they draw Steppenwolf with that classic look also. And that's pretty much the only positive thing. Oh, the colors are great. Love the colors. Really, really good. Kind of fourth world colors, really bright, vibrant colors. And facial expressions throughout the issue are done really, really well. Some of the panels are done with the detail that they're kind of disturbing. And I honestly see that they're meant to be that way. But overall, this for me is a two thumbs down book.
All right, Maddie, don't hold back, man. You can let us know how you really feel.
Well, I mean, I'm just, I like the, you know, the New Gods. Love, you know, big fan of Miracle, Darkseid. Just all the Furies. So I was very excited for this book, and just the direction that I thought if they were going to fight the forces and become. Is, you know, that super powerful team that they are, that we've seen so many times, that Darkseid, you know, that's his go-to people, the Fury. And just the last few issues, just to see the way that they're treated, it's a book trying to really capitalize on some of the social issues of our times that are really big between two sides of politics. And I think it really has no place with these characters at all. Is it? I mean, I get it. That, yeah, they're all women, and most of everyone else on the planet are men. But I think it's the wrong platform to tell this story.
Now I'm going to play devil's advocate. Didn't you like the first issue? I thought I remembered you saying you liked the first issue.
I did, and like I said, I thought they were going to. Move on. I thought we were gonna get more of a team, more of Granny Goodness being that chess player with the awesome pieces that the Furies are, Darkseid backing him up like he so often has, And you know, whatever they were going to get into, I thought it was going to be cosmic. It was going to be great. They were going to maybe even see some great battle sequences or something like that. But no, it just took a, I think it took a turn for the worst. I think it needed to leave that alone. It didn't need it. And sure, you want to send your message, fine. Yeah. Do it in a couple of panels, but
I totally disagree.
Just really left a sour taste in my mouth.
Totally disagree with you. I totally disagree with you. First of all, you know, politics and comics go hand in hand, always have. I understand if that's not your cup of tea, then, you know, that's fine. And if you're not, if you hated the book, then you're totally entitled to that, you know, opinion. But, and I agree with you to some extent. Like, we got a little bit of the misogyny from, in the first issue, from the male characters that live on Apocalypse. And it totally makes sense because Apocalypse is clearly a male dominated society, you know, when you stop and think about it, having these female Furies, the being the go-to to Darkseid, doesn't really make sense when you think about the way their society works and the fact that in modern times that's what we have. It doesn't. It's like, wait, so why should it be that way? And we've never gotten the origin of why it would be that way. And so I kind of think, well, so maybe that's what this is, right? And I do agree with you in that. The first issue, it had a pretty good balance between like action and some flashbacks and, you know, exposition and giving us setup and information. And that was all balanced out with kind of the political aspect of it, you know, the misogynistic tones and kind of the writer's clear disdain for that sort of behavior. And then in the second issue, I feel like the balance wasn't. It wasn't there. In the second issue, we're being like beat over the head with these women are being mistreated. Look at how terrible the men of Apocalypse are. And not only that, not only are the men of Apocalypse misogynistic, which they're villains, so, you know, we'll buy into that. It's not going to bother us. It's not like Superman or Batman, you know, acting like that. Even though if you look back at, you know, comics from the 50s, you know, the way Perry White or even Clark Kent would talk to Lois Lane, you know, not exactly, you know, politically correct, but that's neither here nor there. We don't expect the men of Apocalypse to act with any sort of chivalry or whatever. They're villains. But what we see in this issue is even the fellow Furies are going to Aurelia and being like, you know, they don't believe her, that she's being, you know, harassed and taken advantage of or whatever. And so it makes you think like, God, really? Even now? But you got to remember that this is sort of an origin story. The Furies are nothing when this story starts. Granny is really nothing when the story starts. So I kind of feel like even though we were getting beat over the head with it and I didn't necessarily enjoy it and it kind of made me uncomfortable, I think that was kind of the point. It was to make you uncomfortable and it was to say, okay, look at how bad it was, but I think that you need to do that because that's where you start building up from, right? You got to get to the very bottom of the barrel and then show just how the Furies grow together as a team because of adversity. You know, I imagine something's going to happen with Aurelia. Maybe she's killed. Maybe she's abused to the point where it's obvious to the other Furies that, you know, something's happening, some sort of abuse is happening, and it galvanizes them into becoming this team that we know is, as you said, the go-to for Darkseid. And in that way, it makes total sense, right? Like I was saying, how could a female team, exclusively female team like the Furies, become Darkseid's go-to when they're all females in this male-dominated society? It doesn't really make sense when you stop to think about it, unless something incredible happened. And they proved themselves worthy by basically absolutely destroying anybody who dared stand against them. And what could galvanize that to happen? Well, if their leader, Aurelia, was killed by or completely abused by one of the you know, upper class of Apocalypse. So, the issue was uncomfortable. It was a little, you know, felt like I was getting beat over the head by this political stuff. But I understand it. Did I enjoy it as much as the first issue? No, I really didn't. And I don't know. I'm completely speculating. I don't know what's going to happen in the story, but I'm not giving up hope on it yet. I think it can still be good. And like you said, the artwork's really great. I did notice that you didn't mention any of the creative team. You didn't give the rundown. I don't know if that was because you were going to badmouth it and didn't want them.
No, actually, that was by mistake. I actually pulled it up and then I didn't. So our writer, Cecile Castellucci, and artwork by Adriana Mello, colors by Hi-Fi. Yeah. And the covers by Dan Pinozian. Covers are pretty cool.
Yeah, Dan's a great artist.
I hope that's what it is, and I hope you're right. It's just, sometimes if that's the case, then so be it. But it's a miniseries, so that's moving along.
Yeah, the other thing is that, Cecil, she's very much a champion of feminism. That's who she is. And I don't think she makes any, apologies for that. And she shouldn't. She's written some really great female characters. I mean, what was the Shade? Was it Shade the Changing Girl? Shade the Changing Woman, the two series that she recently finished up at Vertigo. And did you read those? I know you read Eternity Girl, but I don't know if you read Shade.
No, I didn't get to read that. That's one of those that I'm going to go back and read, though. I do enjoy Vertigo and Young Animal. Unfortunately, they're not there anymore. But yeah, I enjoy those imprints, and I plan on going back and reading quite a bit, actually.
Yeah, so I just kind of wonder, I think Cecil's a really talented writer, so I don't think she would substitute politics for good storytelling. So I got to think that it's going to turn all right in the end. But so as much as you disliked issue two, are you going to give it one more issue, or you?
Oh yeah, yeah, I'm definitely going to give it one more issue because I'm hoping that this is kind of as far as turning for the worse, and like you said, it'll turn around. But you respect my theories, man.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the point that she's making, is that people are not respecting the Furies, and in the long run, it's going to come back and bite them in the ass. I hope that's the story that she's going to tell. I think it is. So I guess we'll find out. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is Die number 4. And man, I'm just having the hardest time with creative teams today. Why doesn't anybody just put it? This is what I love about Aftershock, speaking of our sponsor. They put it right there inside the front cover, and you don't have to flip around trying to find it. So anyway, I see more and more books putting it in the back. But I suppose I could always get to the credits when I'm prepping for the podcast instead of searching around for it at the last second. But anyway, Die number 4, written by Kieran Gillen. Art by Stephanie Hans. Letters are by Clayton Cowles. So this has been a great book, and I am not a gamer. I am not an RPG gamer. I've never played Dungeons & Dragons, which I think would surprise a lot of people. But I have seen this book really touch people that are gamers. They really feel like it speaks to them, which I think is really cool. But that's what's great about it, right? I don't think you need to be a gamer to kind of understand the way this book is touching people, and the way that it's exploring that world of sort of being an outcast and feeling different, being marginalized, not to get too political after talking about female Furies. But I know there are times that we've all felt like that. There was a time, and I know this is going to be hard for a lot of you to believe, maybe some that have come to comics recently, that there was a time when reading comics was not cool, and you didn't talk about it because people would make fun of you. And that was me all the way through elementary school, probably until I think in the 90s there it got to be cool for about 5 minutes, and then it sort of went underground again until Iron Man, the first Iron Man movie. But that's a lot of what this story is exploring, what it means to be marginalized, what it means to like something that isn't necessarily what the cool kids like, and how you can come together and become friends through your mutual admiration of things that maybe are a little bit outside of the mainstream, and how those friendships can last a lifetime, and about the dynamics of those friendships and how those friendships change over time. So the basic premise of the story is there was this group of RPG gamers that got together in junior high and used to play, and then they went on a magical journey, basically, that, and we're not exactly sure the mechanics or the architecture of how it worked, but one of them basically created a campaign that essentially transported these people to a fantasy land, like a cross between, I don't know, like J.R.R. Tolkien and Frank L. Baum, you know, and all these years later, they're going back to that world in search of what they don't know. They're pulled back into this world through no choice of their own, and come to find out that the guy that created the initial game and maybe has some sort of power, he's drawn them back because they left him behind, not by choice, but he was left behind when the rest were able to return home many years later after they, or a few years later after they first disappeared. And now we're talking 20 years later, and this group of individuals has come back together. They've been pulled back into the world of Dai by this guy, Saul, who made the game and never made it out. And he's now the grandmaster. He now rules the world. And does he want these guys to escape? Does he want to punish them for having been abandoned and having gone and had a life back on Earth? We're not sure yet, but it's a very interesting take. These characters feel real, and there's a lot of really great references to a lot of other classic fantasy stuff. And it's a very poignant tale. It's a very emotional tale. And I almost think of it like The Big Chill, but like the comic book form of it, or the sort of the geek form of it, where you're getting these people who were so close at one time in their lives and then went their separate ways, and now they're pulled back together, and it could all end up having tragic consequences. But in the meantime, they're learning so much about themselves and each other, and as readers, you can kind of see yourself, different aspects of yourself in these different characters, and maybe you can, you know, learn something about yourself through the interactions of these characters, or learn more about your own relationships. So again, when you tell stories and have fiction like this that are so emotional and so poignant and have so much depth to them, you can get a lot out of it if you put a lot into it, if you know what I mean. It sort of transcends just being a comic and starts to become something so much more than that, I think. So I think Dai is one of the breakout hits of this year, and or actually I think the first issue came out in December, but it's one of the breakout hits of the year, and I'm surprised. I know it already has a huge following. Like there's a fan podcast already. They're coming out with an actual Dai role-playing game. There's forums where you can go and talk to other fans. So it's really become huge very, very quickly, and I think deservedly so. If you haven't checked it out, I definitely recommend it. So you have one more, Manny? Justice League 19?
Justice League 19, yeah. I just have one more. That one is written by Scott Snyder and George Jimenez, with artwork by George Jimenez. So let's start with the story. So this is chapter one of the sixth dimension. So we know what happened in the annual, and we know what kind of what's at stake with the Legion of Doom trying to try and release Perpetua. And this issue pretty much is the Justice League coming up with their plan on how to stop that. And their plan to stop that involves an imp. The one and only Mr. Mixpitalik. That's how you pronounce it, right?
Mixpitalik.
Mixpitalik. Anyway, So they're going to need his help. He's one of the most powerful beings. The two most powerful imps, one that follows Superman, one that follows Batman, is the other one. I thought that was really, really interesting. So they contain him, and they try to formulate a plan on how to go about getting to what they thought was impossible, the sixth dimension. And it goes on to do a pretty good job at explaining how to get there, what it consists of, and the dangers of that certain dimension. Meanwhile, at the same time, the Legion of Doom, Brainiac is warning Lex Luthor that if the League has the imp, then they can be dangerous to their entire plan. I really don't want to give too much away because I'm going to say that the first half is just super enjoyable just because it's fun. Because Mix Pilix, as soon as he gets out, he's all about causing havoc. He starts, some of the things he does to Jon Stewart, he starts having the buildings attack the League, cars attack the League. And then, probably one of the funny parts, I guess I can say that one is Mick says that, you know, he's always in Metropolis because it's a lot more fun than Gotham. And then Batman goes in and chimes in a little bit later. By the way, also, Gotham is more fun than Metropolis. Come on, Batman. We know that's not true. Gotham is very, very gloomy, and there's no chance. But I just thought that it was funny that Batman would be that petty that he'd have to bring that up in a moment like that. It's not the first issue where I've seen something like that where Batman very defiantly defends his city. And so I thought it was a great little ad. And then the second part of the issue, it really gets more into that what I was talking about, explaining the sixth dimension and executing a plan. And it's really what I would come to expect from a Justice League book. I think you and I have already talked about this many times, that the level of what's at risk and you know, something that's really, really going to require the heroes to give everything and to require all of them to get as a league to figure out. I think this is one of those stories. I think that this is that story. And I think that Snyder's doing one hell of a job. You know, we talked about how the first arc ended. The first few arcs ended with the release of Perpetual from Sourcewall. And now this is kicking it off. I am completely sold. And then if you want to talk about artwork, this artwork is fantastic, and it is done. The coloring in it does it so many huge favors too. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful pages from one of the first few pages where you see, I love the first interaction with Clark Kent trying to get an article done on time. And with with so much pressure that he gets it done. It's a really good image, really, really good artwork. And then the entire league with Superman, where they have the creative team, that page is so beautifully done. And I can almost go page by page and just say how much I like it. So I really, really enjoy this artwork. I really enjoyed it's Pilix in this one, and some of the dialogue between Batman and Superman I thought was really great too. Just really overall solid issue. This Justice League is my book of the week.
Yeah, what I really like, the couple things I really like at the end of the story, like the very last page, had me very curious of what's going to happen next, because based on what happens in the story, one of the characters leaves and then almost immediately returns. Then I'm like, oh wait, what happened? And it's so bright and hopeful,
right?
And you're really curious, like, because the character looks like they're changed a little bit, and you're like, oh, well, what happened? I can't wait to find that story. And then you get the last page where you find out things aren't exactly what they seem, and then it just opens up a whole mystery that I can't wait to find out what happens next. The other thing, and probably the thing actually that first stood out to me in this book, like before I even got into the story, was that Jorge Jimenez is listed as a co-plotter on the book.
Right.
Jorge is an incredible artist. And he's an incredible person. Like I met him at San Diego Comic Con a couple years ago. He's so nice. He was, I think it was actually his first time in America. I think he's from Brazil, I want to say. Anyway, somewhere south of the United States. But he was so just happy to be there. He was so appreciative of the fans that were there and that people were coming up to him and they knew his work. And it was just awesome. He was such a great guy. I had a smile on it. Like every time I saw him or talked to him at the DC booth, he had a giant smile on his face. So all the success that he's getting is like so well deserved. And it's great when you see people who are like genuinely like positive and talented and appreciative and humble, like get success. You just feel really good about it. And so I'm really happy to see Jorge getting the recognition he deserves for his artwork. But now he's helping to shape the story. I think that's awesome. I really do. Because Jorge is somebody whose work I will follow like for the rest of his comic book career. Because I think he's that talented. And it would be great if he has some of his own ideas and stories to work on eventually. Or if maybe he'd take over like writing and drawing a book. That would be great. I think there's not enough writer-artists these days. So that's awesome. As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, good for him, man. It couldn't happen to a better person. So that's really
boom, cool. That's your writer-artist for the year.
I don't know. There's a couple of pretty good ones out there these days. So anyway, yeah, Justice League, you know, like Manny and I said, we covered the annual number one, and we're talking about, oh, what happens next? It really felt like an ending, you know, not the end of the story, but sort of the, you know, the ending of the first chapter. And by no means are things in a good shape. by no means is it not bad news coming. So you kind of wondered what was going to happen next. And this is a great start to the next big part of the story. So really can't wait to see what happens. All right, my last book is Self-Made. It is from writer Matthew Groom. We have art by Eduardo Ferragato. Colors are by Marcelo Costa. Color flats are by Mariana Khalil. And letters are by Troy Pateri. And thank you, Matt, for putting the credits right inside the front cover. It's really great. So we had Matt on to talk about Self-Made when the first issue dropped, or right before the first issue dropped. And it was an interesting conversation because based on what you see in the first issue, you kind of have an idea that the story is one thing. And then as soon as issue two comes out, you realize this story is about something completely different. You get a little hint at the end of the first issue that maybe it's more than meets the eye. And then when issue two comes, issue two is my favorite issue of the series so far. Three and four are good, one's good, but two was just like a nearly perfect comic. It was so amazing. So it's not the most original idea in the world. It's a computer programmer who has inadvertently created an artificial intelligence, and then come to find out maybe not so inadvertently. And what happens next? And so what I really love about it is the fact that it is taking this idea that we've seen in science fiction many times before, and it's putting a different face on it. And the first three issues, it really integrates things that are sort of relevant and a lot of people can relate to in terms of today's pop culture. And now with issue four, we've sort of taken the next step. And we're moving on to sort of a different setting that makes it feel a little more grounded and dangerous. There's a little more of a sense of menace now. Things are kind of getting a little more real, so to speak. The danger level and the consequences for our characters are starting to become much higher. And so, again, I think it's for a first-time comic writer, again, this is Matthew Groom, who hasn't written anything previously. A lot of people might know him from his Power Rangers podcast, actually, and that's sort of how Self-Made came about, because Matt was doing the podcast, he got a chance to meet Kyle Higgins, who I'm a huge fan of, great comic book writer, great content creator, went to film school, has made a couple of really great short films. And Kyle was on the podcast, on the Power Ranger podcast, and became friends with Matt, and they got to talking, and Matt told him about this idea he had for a story, and Kyle Higgins is actually editing this book. He's the editor helping guide the story. And so, you know, if somebody is talented and as well respected as Kyle Higgins is, basically, you know, putting his name on something, even if it's just as the editor, you know, it's quality. And that's been the case all along. And so when we had Matt on, he was very grateful, very humble, and very appreciative of all the efforts that Kyle was making. And we talked about the fact that the first issue was paced so well. And because, again, I sound like a broken record here. I've talked so many times about how pacing is the hardest thing to get right when you're a new creator. And I think, and Matt's aware of this, having Kyle in his corner and be able to bounce ideas off and help him with kind of the pacing of the story. You know, again, all credit to Matt, and I'm sure Kyle would say the same thing, that he's been able to nail the pacing so far. It's been relatively fast paced. We're getting a big enough chunk of story each time to feel satisfied, but it still leaves you wanting more. So again, it's a really, really great story, really fun. And especially, I just keep going back to issue two. I could reread that book again, like over and over. It's so well done, and I'm hoping we get more issues like that where everything just seems to kind of sync up perfectly. Which, you know, again, if you're telling story, it's got to be, you know, peaks and valleys. So you know, if everything is dialed up to 11 all the time, then there's never any payoff. You know, we've talked about that before on the podcast with various creators as well. So it's an interesting story, and I'm very curious to see what happens next. I think I have to give this my book of the week. You know, as great as Green Arrow 50 was, and it was a really, really great issue, I think I have to give Self-Made number 4 my book of the week, with just the little caveat that it's been my own fault that I haven't mentioned the last, like I said, we talked when the first issue came out, it was great. And then I've been reading along, but I didn't talk about issue 2 or 3 when they came out, and I probably should have, just to kind of keep it on everybody's radar. So based on the strength of this issue and the strength on the series overall, I'm going to give Self-Made number 4 my book of the week. Not to say that there aren't some other great titles out there. Die was great. Young Justice was great. As you know, we said Green Arrow was outstanding, but I want to make sure everybody gets out there and picks up Self-Made, because it's really spectacular. So let's go ahead and give a rundown on some of the other issues that are out this week. From Aftershock, we have Oberon number 2 and Walk Through Hell number 8. I talked about both of those on the Aftershock Monday episode this last week. And I know you read Oberon, Manny. Did you read Walk Through Hell yet?
No, actually, I'm like 2 issues behind on that. So when you told me that, I'm like, oh, gotta catch up, but I haven't yet.
Oh man, that you want to talk about? I was saying Fatal Fury is making you uncomfortable. Yeah, Walk Through Hell, it'll make you uncomfortable big time. That's by far the most brutal issue so far, and it's, yeah. Even thinking about it right now, I'm just like, ugh. But yeah, that was really good. And Oberon as well, really kicks that story into high gear. So that's been really great. Over at Dark Horse, we have Black Hammer 45, number 1. It's basically, Jeff Lemire's Black Hammer story, but now we're in 1945. So I'm guessing World War II. Not 100%. I'm way behind on Black Hammer. I know it's really, really great. I read the first arc, and it's another one of those titles I've been buying the physical copies, and I'm just so far behind. I really need to get caught up. Manny mentioned Batman 66, and we also talked about Green Arrow and Green Lantern. We also have Harley Quinn number 59 coming out from DC. as well as the Justice League 19 that that Manny just talked about. Over at Image, it's kind of a light week. Usually you're used to seeing a lot of Image books, but there's only about 10 this week, including the final issue of Cemetery Beach, number 7, from Warren Ellis. I read the first two issues of that, and it was good, but not great, and I haven't gotten back to it yet, so I need to do that. We also have Deadly Class from Rick Remender, number 37. Eclipse, number 13, as that very much incredible, well-loved title, at least as far as we're concerned, returns from Zach Kaplan. And we'll be talking about Eclipse, number 13, as well as Vindication, number 2, which are both Top Cow books. We'll be talking about those on tomorrow's Top Cow Thursday. Spoiler-free or extremely light spoilers, so just be aware. If you are reading those or don't want them spoiled for you, make sure you pick those up and put them at the top of your stack. They're both really incredible issues. I think Manny and I both agreed that Vindication number 2, you know, as good as one, issue 1 was, 2 was way better, and Eclipse was up to its usual high-quality standards. We also have Paper Girls, number 26 from Image, Brian K. Vaughan. It's coming out tomorrow. Over at Marvel, the Age of X-Men event continues with Prisoner X, number 1. We also have the weekly Avengers series No Road Home. It's up to number 4. The final issue of Black Order from Derek Landry is out tomorrow with issue number 5. Conan the Barbarian, is that a weekly series? I swear we've had a Conan issue like every week. It's up to issue 4 already. I feel like the first issue just barely came out. And then because people can't seem to get enough of Cosmic Ghost Rider, I could. Two issues of Cosmic Ghost Rider was more than enough for me.
Right.
I dropped it like third period French. But anyway, he's got a new series coming out called Cosmic Ghost Rider Destroys Marvel History.
He's in Guardians of the Galaxy also.
Six issues of he's in Guardians of the Galaxy?
Yep.
You know, I was planning on checking out the first issue of that. I may just...
It's actually pretty good.
I may just have to skip it. We'll see. Anyway, new six-issue miniseries coming out starring Cosmic Ghost Rider. So if you're curious, definitely pick that up. Domino Hot Shots, number 1 of 5 from Gail Simone. And I was reading the other day that apparently they thought her and David Baldione, the artist for Domino, thought that this originally they were brought on for only like 5 issues, and then people loved it so much they just kept on and kept on and kept on, and now they have this Hot Shots series, and it sounds like they want to do more Domino, so we may have more Domino coming from Gail Simone in the future. Immortal Hulk, which is pretty much the best Marvel comic in recent memory, is up to issue 14, and we mentioned Killmonger earlier, Juan Ferreira's current title, with writer Brian Edward Hill. That comes to conclusion tomorrow as well, or today as you're listening to this, with issue number 5. We also have, just in time for the Captain Marvel movie, which I got my tickets. I'm anxious to go see it this weekend. We have a Meet the Skrulls, number 1 of 5. So another miniseries starring, or another miniseries from Marvel, I should say, starring the Skrulls. And Uncanny X-Men is up to number 13. And that does it. There's no Valiant books this week. So anything else that you're looking forward to, Manny, that I did not mention?
No, you got it.
Right on. So are you planning on going to see Captain Marvel this weekend?
Yeah, actually, I think Emma and I are going to see it on Thursday. Actually, here in town, they're doing a special screening for it. But it's almost like an event here. I'm really surprised that somebody's throwing something like that. So, definitely going to go check that out.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, the movies used to actually open on Friday night. And then as the hype machine got bigger and bigger and bigger, then it was like, okay, well, we can release it. Like, technically, Friday starts Thursday at midnight. So then there started, you know, they would
do midnight showings.
Yeah, so you could see it. And then Friday at, or, you know, Thursday/Friday at 12 a.m. became, let's show it Thursday at 10. That way more people can come. And then 10 became like 7. And now, I mean, I don't know how it is where you are, you live in a smaller town, but here in Phoenix, yeah, there's like, it basically starts playing Thursday at 7 p.m. everywhere.
I think that's the rule of thumbs, is the earliest you can play the movie is Thursday at 7.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like the Thanksgiving, the Black Friday thing, you know, now it starts on, yep, on Wednesday.
Yep. It's the creep, man. You know, they just keep creeping it forward.
So, yeah, no, it's, you know, it's, the more, the sooner it's going to be pretty good. And some of it was filmed in our backyard over at Bass Lake. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, those scenes.
Wait, and there's Captain Marvel scenes that were filmed at Bass Lake?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, I think they were here for like a week or two. And up there at Bass Lake, they're filming some a couple of scenes. They completely closed everything off. But yeah, that's they did some of the filming here.
So listeners, Manny lives where I used to live, and it's pretty close to where he's talking about. And that place that he's talking about, Bass Lake, that's where my wife is from. So that's pretty interesting.
Oh, cool.
And if any of you listeners remember the classic, incredible, hilarious movie with John Candy and Dan Aykroyd, The Great Outdoors, that was filmed at Bass Lake as well.
That's right.
Great, great movie. So, all right. Well, I guess that's going to do it for New Comics Wednesday. Be sure to join us tomorrow. As I mentioned, for Top Cow Thursday, we'll be talking about a couple more books that were released today. Eclipse number 13 and Vindication number 2. As I talked about a little while ago. So I hope you all join us. Also, don't forget, this episode has been brought to you by Aftershock Comics, one of the most exciting independent publishers putting out titles today. They're edgy, they're diverse, they're from talented creators whose names you know, like Donnie Cates, Marguerite Bennett, Garth Ennis. So we highly encourage everybody to go to aftershockcomics.com. You can click on the drop-down menu under Series. You can check out series synopsis of all their titles, as well as the creative lineups. There's even links there where you can go and buy digital copies from Comixology. So be sure you go and check it out. And don't forget to tune in on Mondays for our Aftershock Monday episodes, where we spotlight a lot of these incredible books, as well as interviews with the creators who are producing them for Aftershock. Well, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. So thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network. So when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites. And finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.